This is Trump Watch. I'm John Wiener, live in LA on 90.7 KPFK, talking about what Trump is actually doing, not just what he's tweeting. Coming up later in this hour, maybe you heard today's news, Republicans in the Senate finally unveiled their health care bill today. Four Republicans say they are against it, and they can only lose two. Harold Meyerson will comment. Also, high crimes and misdemeanors. John Nichols will make the case for impeachment. And first up, the Jared Report with Amy Willens. Trump Watch starts right now. Well, today, Jared Kushner, the most trusted man in the Trump White House, is in Israel, where he is supposed to bring peace to the Middle East. He's also being investigated by the special counsel for his actions involving Russia during and after the campaign. And he's got big things going for the family business in China. For our Jared Report, we turn to Amy Willens. She's a longtime contributing editor at The Nation. She was Jerusalem correspondent for The New Yorker. She writes award-winning books on Haiti. Amy, welcome back.
Thanks, John.
Well, you covered Mideast politics for The New Yorker. What do you think are the chances that this young and good-looking son-in-law of the president, you're already shaking your head, no. What do you think are the chances he will succeed on his Mideast peace mission?
There are always miracles in the Holy Land, so you never know. And besides, in the Holy Land, another rule of thumb is predict what you don't think will happen, because that's the most likely thing to happen. So I give Jared his, there's a possibility, you know. I have never seen someone look so much like he swallowed the canary. Is that the, is that what you say? But Netanyahu is so happy. It's just like he's beaming every time he thinks about Trump in the White House. And then there's a great clip online, if anyone wants to look at it, of Netanyahu welcoming Jared to Jerusalem, I guess. And Jared walks in the room very stiff, and he looks like, you know, he's, I hate to say it, it is my people, so I can say it. He looks like a bar mitzvah boy going, and he hasn't quite practiced what he's supposed to say. And therefore, as usual with Jared, he doesn't say much. But Netanyahu, it's just, it's like a grandfather welcoming home his little grandson. He's so happy. And he makes a great little Freudian slip, Netanyahu, where he goes like, and I am so pleased that I'll be working you in the next few years. And I thought, yeah, that's right, Bibi. You're going to be working him because he's not going to be working you.
Maybe Bibi's command of English is not really.
Oh, yeah. No, Bibi's command of English is perfect.
Jared did announce before he left, he was asked, or his spokesperson was asked, what was his approach going to be? And the announcement was he was going to start by asking each side to list their priorities. Very bold start, don't you think?
It's a good start. If you haven't ever read anything about the Middle East, why not just ask people what they want? If you've read anything, you might A, mistrust the answer you get, B, already know what their priorities are, C, understand that there's a very difficult question at the heart of this, which lies in the fact that they both want the same land. And Jared, as a real estate maven, should understand that wanting the same land is kind of a difficult thing to reconcile.
Kind of a difficult thing. Jared Kushner is also an Orthodox Jew. Is that relevant to his bringing peace to the Mideast?
Well, on the one hand, it probably makes him seem more desirable as a mediator. And on the other hand, it makes him seem less desirable as a mediator. Obviously, I think the Palestinian Authority is going to be a little leery of an Orthodox Jew as a moderate force when what they've seen in Israel is that the Orthodoxy is not a moderating force on Israeli policy and hasn't been for a long time. So it will be hard for them to trust someone like Jared Kushner. On the other hand, he used to have a reputation as a liberal, so maybe they are looking at that also.
There's the Nixon in China possibility that it will take an Orthodox Jew to get the Israelis to
Yes, I agree. But I think that Nixon, whatever his foibles may have been, was an extremely canny person. And he had also canny advisors, shall we say, who could profit from situations. I don't get that feeling from Kushner at all. He seems very unprepared and, not ready for what may be facing him there.
If you Google Jared and Russia, you get about 12.7 million results. I wonder if you've looked at any of these.
Well, obviously, one has looked at these. I did Jared and Bibi this morning, so I didn't do Jared and Russia this morning. But Jared and Russia, of course, his entanglement with the ambassador and then with the businessman, I'm forgetting
the
his
bank,
name,
the
head of the government bank, basically what yeah. is the government bank. These are disturbing things that are being investigated now. The special prosecutor is beginning to look into these ties that were ongoing during the campaign meetings. I can't say ties because that implies constant contact.
Meetings is good.
And that extended even beyond the campaign into the transition. So, we don't really know what it is. But it doesn't look good in a country that's imposing sanctions on another country. It's confusing.
What we have been told is that Jared was in a meeting with Kislyak, the ambassador, asking for a secret back channel where he could communicate with Yeltsin's people, and that we are told he proposed to do this through.
I think you mean Putin.
Putin, through Putin, perhaps at a Russian diplomatic facility, not using the United States government means of communicating with the Russians. And that leads us to ask, why would Jared want to communicate with Putin through a Russian communications link? Isn't that something that would be secret from the United States?
Yeah, isn't that disturbing? And then that he'd never put down on his clearance papers any of the contacts he did have with the Russians and other foreign entities. So that's also a disturbing fact. But the idea that you would shield your communications with an ally or an enemy by using their form of communications is bizarre indeed.
Well, let's speculate on what might have been going on there. Of course, the official story is Jared and the other Trump representatives were only preparing for the transition and discussing with the Russians what Trump's policies might be towards them in the future, which is a perfectly legitimate thing to do. The Russians were interested in lifting sanctions. This is something that's certainly discussable when a new president comes in. So there's nothing wrong with talking to Putin's representatives.
But one wants to say, pardon me, we can do that at a conference table. Right? You don't need to go to a secure facility in Minsk to have that conversation. You can have it at a conference table. You can have it at the embassy. You can have it with reporters outside who ask you questions afterward. I know the Trump administration doesn't really like to do that, but that's possible. The problem is if you're negotiating some kind of quid pro quo about the sanctions. Mm. And that's been the concern all along with this secret channel that supposedly was being organized. And the other problem is if you want to talk about things that were done that weren't proper, like interrupting a presidential campaign,
disrupting, hacking,
all those things that are in question now, you might not want to talk about it at a conference table with reporters outside.
And if you are engaged in perfectly legitimate diplomatic conversations, why would you lie about it?
Why would you conceal it?
Why would you conceal it? That implies there's something you don't want people to know if there was a quid pro quo, and there's been a lot of speculation about this. What would Jared Kushner of Kushner Properties want in exchange for helping lift the sanctions? What might he want?
You just hate to think of what he might want. Might he want concessions in various cities for properties? Might he want a deal on certain properties?
How about a loan, Russian or, banks or
Russian
connected banks
to the
New Jersey operations of the Kushner company?
But you just hate to feel that it could be something as base and sort of mob-like as that would enter into a diplomatic relationship between two countries.
You wouldn't want to think there was something as base and mob-like.
And
as...
then think, imagine this. Perhaps this is just rampant speculation, but if the Russians were involved in hacking the American election but don't really want to say that they were involved, the Trump administration could use that against them as in a form of blackmail, international blackmail, to get those sort of lower, more base things for business. That is true. And the reason we speculate in this way, you know, many people would say, oh, it's because you're just Trump haters. But it's actually because there are so many instances where the Trump administration has shown an utter disregard for the simple concept of conflict of interest and the problems of business and government.
You mentioned the application for a security clearance. Jared Kushner did not tell the truth on his application for a security clearance. So why should he have a security clearance?
He shouldn't have a security clearance, according to several experts on this particular field. If you have not, now they understand that you may make a mistake on your forms, and they could argue, Jared could certainly argue that he, oh, oops, it slipped my mind that I've had dealings with various foreign entities. But even in the case where it's just a mistake or an omission that you forgot, they don't give you your security clearance until the thing is rectified. But Jared has security clearance and has had security clearance, which means he knows an awful lot that perhaps a person with his connections ought not to know.
Well, we have some tape of Jared speaking that we want to listen to here. Normally, this wouldn't be a very big deal, but Jared is known for his silence. He is known for keeping a low profile, for speaking only in private, speaking only behind the scenes. He made his first public speech as a White House advisor last week, or I think it was Monday, on this Monday.
Yes.
One of his many assignments at the White House is to lead the effort to upgrade American technology, something you might think somebody who basically rents buildings wouldn't be an expert on. But
He's young.
He's good looking. And he spoke at the White House to a gathering of America's leading tech CEOs and gurus. Let's listen to about a minute of Jared speaking at the White House.
We've assembled a very impressive group of leaders from the private sector and are putting them to work here today to work on some of the country's biggest challenges that will make a very meaningful difference to a lot of its citizens. This is Technology Week here at the White House, and we are proud to be kicking it off with your engagement and assistance as we work to modernize the government's technology infrastructure. We created the White House Office of American Innovation in an effort to bring business sensibility to a government that for too long has relied on past practices as automatic justification for their continuation. Before I came to Washington, many warned me that the bureaucracy would resist any change that we tried to implement. So far, I have found exactly the opposite. To date, we've been working with hundreds of talented civil servants, men and women, who want to serve their country and see their government do better. We have challenged ourselves to pursue change that will provide utility to Americans far beyond our tenure here. Together, we have set ambitious goals and empowered interagency teams to tackle our objectives. It's working, and it's very exciting.
It's very exciting. Amy Willens, are you excited?
I am so excited. I'm stoked. It has been pointed out that he sounds like Michael Cera in his earlier roles. I keep thinking it's like a kid who's like doing a book report in front of his class. And when you watch him, it looks that way. Like someone wrote it for him. I mean, this is always the case with politicians. But what really strikes you is how good Trump is at talking and how very, very bad Jared is at talking. I don't even know if anyone is still listening out there after that.
Yes, I fear
and
we...
I hope you didn't crash your cars falling asleep. It's just...
I fear we lost half our audience in that 60-second period. Well, you're right. He's certainly no challenge to his father-in-law in the public rhetoric department.
No, but another thing that's interesting about Jared and the family is that the Trump administration has had a lot of problem hiring talent. Part of it is people don't really feel comfortable working for Trump. They don't know how it's going to go down. They don't want to join the administration. And then another reason is that the Trump family is leery of experts and people who know more than they do. But because of that lack, this really quite seemingly not that talented and not that expert and not that necessarily smart, although who knows, person has been in charge, been put in charge of a million different things. And it's quite odd.
We've only got two or three minutes left here. There is one thing that Jared does seem to be an expert at, and that's renting real estate. The New York Times did a big investigation of the Trump, of the Kushner company's rental practices. What did they find?
Well, they found that they the Kushner real estate people buy up an awful lot of low-income housing rentals. And in the Maryland market, they bought something like 20,000 units. And of those units, they have put forward cases, legal cases against something like 548 of their renters. That's a large percentage of your renters to be suing at the same time. And apparently, according to the New York Times, which perhaps the Trump administration might not trust, a lot of those cases are kind of questionable
harassment
of tenants. And unfortunately, in the new budget that the Trump administration is proposing, legal services is being basically just canceled. And legal services, of course, is what provides legal counsel to tenants who can't afford a lawyer.
So big picture here, we used to think just a few months ago that Jared Kushner was the calm voice of reason in the Trump White House. What do we think now about Jared's role?
We think he's a calm voice. I would say that's been proven in this segment. But I think he's an empty vessel, and he is being kind of like a Ken doll pushed around from one thing to another by the administration and not with a lot of thought behind what they're doing. He's like a pawn. And, you know, I think this is well-founded because of his business past. I can't trust him. I don't trust him, and I certainly don't think he's a liberal voice. He's like his wife. They've signed on, they're committed, and they're going with the flow.
Amy Willens with The Jared Report. Amy, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks, John.
I'm John Wiener, live in L.A. on 90.7 KPFK with Trump Watch. Next up, Senate Republicans and their health care bill. Harold Meyerson will comment. That's in a minute when Trump Watch continues. It's the same old story. This is Trump Watch. I'm John Wiener, live in L.A. on KPFK, streaming at kpfk.org, and online anytime you want it at trumpwatchpodcast.com. Later in this hour, high crimes and misdemeanors. John Nichols will talk about impeaching you-know-who. But first, Republicans today in the Senate finally revealed what was in their health care bill. It's an extremely unpopular proposal. The latest from the NBC poll is that 16% of Americans approve of the Republican proposals to repeal and replace Obamacare. And there are four Republicans in the Senate who say they will not support the bill in its present form. Only two of them can vote no. So it will be interesting to see what kind of deals are made by Mitch McConnell in the coming days. For comment, we turn to Harold Meyerson. Of course, he's executive editor of the American Prospect and a regular contributor to the LA Times op-ed page. Harold, welcome back.
Always good to be here, John.
So what can you tell us about the long-awaited reveal of what the Republicans are proposing in the Senate? How different is it from the House? And what do you make of the four who are currently saying no?
Well, it's not all that different, nor should we actually have expected that it would be. It makes massive cuts to Medicaid, and it differs from the House bill in that it takes a couple years longer to do that, which, given you know, the senators' terms last 6 years, this gives the senators you know, maybe one free re-election before the Medicaid expansion under the ACA is totally gone. So it does that. It repeals all of the progressive taxes that were part of the ACA to fund the health care subsidies, so it really gives a massive billions of dollars back to the rich. In fact, headline in the Wall Street Journal online after this said, you know, huge tax cuts for the rich. So if that's Wall Street Journal characterization, it's good enough for me.
Let's go with it.
And you know, it's interesting. The four hard right senators in the Republican caucus, Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, Mike Lee from Utah, and Ron Johnson from Wisconsin, said they would oppose the bill that Mitch McConnell unveiled today unless it were it went further to repeal any notion of an individual American having a right to health care. What it did not get, interestingly, any such ringing declarations from the so-called Republican moderates, some of whom we know are concerned about these provisions, if only because they have so many Medicaid recipients in their states, many of whom voted for Trump or for them, people like Susan Collins in Maine or Lisa Murkowski in Alaska or Rob Portman in Ohio. You know, but moderate Republicans are kind of an invertebrate form of life, so it's not clear where they will come down on this. Of course, the trick here, the problem is, the more McConnell leans to appease the four senators who came out against the bill today, it may get harder. Really make it harder for Republicans in swing states to support the bill. One such, obviously, and he's up for election in November, re-election in November of 2018, and is generally considered the most endangered Republican Senate incumbent, is Dean Heller from Nevada, who has been grumbling about this for about the bill for a while. So it's really not clear where this goes. I mean, Republicans have to be afraid. This is what's tricky about this. Republicans have to be afraid of two distinct kind of electoral challenges. One from the Republican base, who are the only people who support Trump, who support this kind of stuff in a primary if they don't vote for the bill. And if they're from a swing state with a lot of Medicaid recipients, as a number of them are, like Dean Heller in Nevada, they have to be afraid about a challenge in the general election that they could lose. So that's why this is a bit of a tightrope walk for the Republicans. And of course, we have to hope that they all fall off the tightrope. But because if this thing passes, it's the most major takeaway of a significant not just a significant government benefit, but a significant right from the American people. We've seen in I'm tempted to say possibly ever, because major social programs that become established in the American landscape usually don't get repealed.
Eugene Robinson at the Washington Post op-ed page wrote recently that if the Republicans do succeed in repealing and replacing Obamacare with their current bills, that's the biggest push we will get towards a single-payer Medicare for all type system in the United States. If they fail to repeal and replace Obamacare, it will take a lot longer before we get to Medicare for all. I wonder if you agree with that.
That may be true. If I were one of the people pushing the single-payer bill in California, I would add up, you know, the comparison is how much do taxes have to go up compared to what they are now to support a single-payer bill in California. But, you know, the comparison, if this were to pass, it would be how much would taxes have to go up to pay for single-payer in California if this bill were passed, and it would actually be less than if it didn't, because so much of the Medicaid responsibility would be thrown back on the state anyway.
Yes.
If this Republican bill is passed, that the cost to taxpayers of providing the current system would rise hugely in California. So, you know, I mean, it's complicated. You know, the line that many people have, and it's not wrong, would be if we were starting from a clean slate with no existing health insurance structure in place, it would be much more easy to go to a single payer system than it is now. Well, I mean, the Republicans are doing a bit of a job here of dismantling the existing system.
Yes.
And so in the absence of same, yes, it probably is easier to get to single payer, but anyone who knows American history still knows that that doesn't mean it's easy.
Now we need to move on to the next big topic, recriminations among Democrats over John Ossoff's loss of that contested Republican House seat in suburban Atlanta. Here's what Don Guttenplan said at The Nation about the Democrats putting, what, $20 million into this campaign and then losing it. Not even very close race. The Nation says, we were reminded time and again by the media that an Ossoff win, the Clintonian Democratic candidate, would have also been a victory over the left. It would have been trumpeted as a vindication of an un-Sanders-like vision of the future, incited as proof that Democrats who want to win should follow this model and explicitly rule out raising taxes on the wealthy and oppose any move towards single-payer health care. So, The Nation writes, I'm not sorry he lost, close quote. I wonder if you agree with that.
The Nation didn't write that. Don Guttenplan wrote that.
Don Guttenplan wrote that in The Nation. Yes.
Yes, exactly. And I don't think that that's a view that would necessarily get consensus in The Nation offices, having spent some time in The Nation offices. It's certainly true that Ossoff ran sort of the ultimate nebbish campaign. You know, he really almost didn't say anything. I mean, there was an inverse relationship between the content of his proposals and the frequency of the fundraising emails that came out of that campaign. I don't know, someone could chart that mathematically, I'm sure. But, you know, Guttenplan is right up to a point that you know, the third way folks, who are, I think, less powerful these days than some on the left, and I consider myself on the left, would imagine, would have said that, well, this is a formula for winning elsewhere. But I don't think, you know, most party operatives would not have thought that, establishment operatives as well as anti-establishment operatives. He was running in a southern suburban district, which is not really like a northern suburban district or anything like that. I mean, I think basically The Nation piece simply concludes too much. it is right in concluding that the guy ran a ridiculous campaign. It is wrong, I think, in concluding that that campaign would have been embraced as a model by the Democratic establishment outside similar suburban districts in the South, almost none of which really are going to, not too many of which are going to be contested in any event in November 2018.
So are there any implications in the Atlanta results for California Democrats? California has the strongest and most successful Democratic Party anywhere in the country. Our goal here is to flip the remaining Republican congressional districts in next year's midterm elections. Five of those Republican seats are here in Southern California. Where's the California Democratic Party on the issues raised by this Ossoff campaign and the critique from the Bernieites?
Well, I think the California districts that are in play will see Democratic candidates who will be much more critical of Trump than Ossoff was. I mean, Ossoff backed off being even critical of Trump, and that's not. I can't imagine any Democrats in California running in those districts who are going to follow Ossoff on that approach. I think they will be, strongly critical of the policies of the Trump administration, advocating, I suspect, since there's some interesting changes in the wind in the Democratic establishment here in D.C. for major public jobs campaigns, the kind of energy policies. Will everyone there, will all of them support single payer? I don't know. I also happen to think that the crisis issue in California, actually more than health care, there are two. There's the whole treatment of immigrants, on which I don't think there's going to be any real difference between the Sanders and the Clinton people. And there's affordable housing, on which there's not a single wing of the Democratic Party that really has a good idea about that yet. So, we shall see.
Well, I want to talk now about the new issue of the American Prospect, which just published an important set of articles on white working class politics. You have the lead piece there. You say we shouldn't have been surprised that a significant proportion of the white working class abandoned the Democrats last November, abandoned them either by not voting for Hillary or by voting for Trump. Why shouldn't we have been surprised?
Well, I mean, to begin with, if anyone is just following elections in the Midwest, the Republicans had come to dominate Wisconsin. I mean, Scott Walker had been elected three times in Wisconsin, Michigan, Indiana. All three states not only had Rothwell Republican leadership, but much more right-wing Republican leadership than they historically had. They'd all become right-to-work states, that sort of stuff. So why we still consider those states part of the blue wall is a damn good question. Beyond that, there were two, to use a phrase of Thomas Jefferson, two fire bells in the night that sounded in the previous year that seemed to have no effect on Democratic strategy. One was the rather well-publicized study by Nobel laureate Angus Deaton and public health advocate Anne Case, they're a married couple, showing that the lifespan of working class whites was declining.
Yeah.
That didn't suggest that all was well there. And then there was a report that came out last year from something called the Economic Innovation Group, which looked at where businesses were dying and where businesses were starting. And what they basically concluded was that the recovery was entirely located within major metropolitan areas. That if you were in a rural county, the county with, say, fewer than 100,000 residents, in the recovery after the early 90s recession, 32% of new businesses were created were in those small counties. In the recovery after the dot-com bust of 2000, that 32% fell to 15% of the new businesses created in the country were in those small rural areas, counties with 100,000 or fewer. And in the current recovery, 2010 to 2014, the share of new businesses created in those counties was a flat zero.
Ooh.
Zero. You know, among other things, if you think a private sector infrastructure program, you think any of those people are going to go to rural America, which is devoid of new business and devoid of new jobs and devoid of money, and think they can make money there, and so they're going to build any infrastructure there, you've got another thing coming. So the point I was making is this. Yeah, there's a lot of the white working class that is simply lost to the Democrats for sort of profound cultural, even tribal reasons, and that's a given. But there's also, you know, a good deal of data from some very smart public opinion analysts showing that there is a swing constituency of 8 to 12% that can go either way among white working class residents. Politically, for that reason, and just, I think, morally in general, the Democrats really need to have economic development policies. And I cite the example of one well-known Democrat named Franklin Roosevelt, and that a major feature of the New Deal, I mean, it wasn't just Social Security and rights for labor, it was an economic development policy for the backward parts of the country then, for the South, the Tennessee Valley Authority, hydroelectric power in the West, the Rural Electrification Administration. There was a conscious policy of bringing up the underdeveloped parts of the United States economically. When was the last time the Democrats had something like that? I think there's a lot of public job and construction and broadband and infrastructure stuff that would benefit, you know, both the urban poor and the rural poor, and the rural poor who weren't thinking of themselves as poor until the last 15 or 20 years. Not just rural, also small towns. Again, the concentration of the recovery in major metropolitan cities is really profound. Just to quote that EIG, the Economic Innovation Group study again, in the recovery after the 1990 downturn, in counties with more than a million, only 13% of the new businesses were established in that county. But in the recovery of the last few years, that 13% became 58%. So really, there's just a concentration of economic activity. I mean, it's basically American capitalism has fled the boondocks almost completely. And ironically, since the Republicans are the laissez-faire party, that's not really something they can address. I mean, if it's going to be addressed at all, it's going to be addressed by people who believe in, government intervention in the economy and government-backed economic development.
Well, Harold, I'm sorry we're out of time. Obviously, this is just the beginning of this conversation. The special section of the American Prospect on working-class politics we'll need to devote more than one show to that because it's so rich and so deep. Harold Meyerson, read his special reports at the American Prospect. Thank you, Harold.
Thank you, John.
I'm John Wiener, live in L.A. on 90.7 KPFK, and this is Trump Watch. Next up, the case for impeachment. That's in a minute on KPFK when Trump Watch continues. It's the same old story. This is Trump Watch. I'm John Wiener, live in L.A. on KPFK, streaming at kpfk.org and online anytime you want it at trumpwatchpodcast.com. Coming up at 4 tonight on KPFK, This Is Happening, Jerry Quickly. But first,
high crimes and misdemeanors. Those, of course, are the constitutional grounds for impeaching the president. Has Trump committed high crimes and misdemeanors? For some answers, we turn to John Nichols. He's the nation's national affairs correspondent. We reach him today in Madison. John, welcome back.
John, it's great to be with you.
Well, what do you think about high crimes and misdemeanors? And what does Congressman Brad Sherman of California think about high crimes and misdemeanors?
Well, I think high crimes and misdemeanors are bad, and you shouldn't commit them.
Okay.
And I think that if you do, you have met the constitutional standard for impeachment. Now, you might have thought there that you heard a rather vague answer because I just said they're bad. Well, frankly, that's what the founders intended when they wrote the extensive constitutional sections dealing with the issue of impeachment. It's brought up more than, you know, all sorts of things that we talk about all the time. You don't have to have a conviction in court. You don't have to have, you know, the classic outlines of an indictment. What you have to have is a broad understanding that a president is acting in a way that is harmful to the republic, that is at odds with his or her oath of office, that is damaging to the basic constructs of democracy. By that standard, Donald Trump is eminently impeachable. He is impeachable for his disregard of the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution, something we've been talking about for a long time. He is impeachable for numerous abuses of his authority. And this comes up in areas that are very rarely discussed. For instance, how he and the people around him have handled their executive orders even after they've been tossed by the courts, their efforts to continue to push forward on things where they've been told they shouldn't do it, and a host of other matters related to just the day-to-day operations, which are disrespectful of the rule of law, diminishing of the rule of law. But most importantly of late is what we learned from the firing of James Comey and its aftermath. No matter what you think about the Russia controversies and all the scandals and issues that are now being investigated at multiple levels, we know that James Comey was fired by President Trump because President Trump was concerned about the work that Comey was doing as the head of an investigation into, at the very least, Trump's associates, potentially Trump. That is an obstruction of justice. That is an abuse of power. When you impeached Richard Nixon, and the House Judiciary Committee moved to impeach Richard Nixon back in 1974, in their first article of impeachment, what they outlined was obstruction of justice, specifically involving actions with the FBI and abuses of power. Now, you asked about Congressman Brad Sherman.
Yeah, so let me re-ask. Let me re-ask the question. And what does Congressman Brad Sherman of California think about high crimes and misdemeanors?
Well, it looks like he's a very wise man because he agrees with me.
Okay.
Congressman Brad Sherman, and I'm not obviously being a little witty there, hopefully. He is obviously acting on his own volition and responding to the developments of recent weeks. But he's come to a conclusion very similar to what I just described. And that is that the Comey testimony, as well as a number of things the president himself has said, and that associates of the president have said, clearly point to obstruction of justice, not merely under the broader impeachment standard, but as Sherman suggests, even when you look at specific legal concerns, as well as abuses of power. So what Brad Sherman did, and I thought it was a very wise way to approach this, and a way that you might expect a multi-term veteran member of Congress who served on a lot of the key committees. He went back to the 1974 Articles of Impeachment against Nixon. He looked at the standards that the House Judiciary Committee applied after months of inquiry and lots of assessment, contacting constitutional scholars, looking at, you know, all the issues that were in play. And he drew up an article of impeachment that is grounded in, you might even say, an extension of what the Judiciary Committee did four decades ago. Because although the cases are very different and the times are very different, and individuals are very different, you still have this classic obstruction of justice and abuse of power. And so he has moved an article of impeachment, circulating it now in the House for sign-ons, that proposes the impeachment of the president for those high crimes and misdemeanors. He says that he will submit it formally in short order. It will then be, you know, a live article of the Congress. It will be a reality. We will have an impeachment resolution in play. Brad Sherman's a smart man, savvy political figure. He understands it's a Republican-controlled Congress and that there will be resistance on the part of Donald Trump's number one apologist and defender, Paul Ryan, and others in Congress. But what he says, he outlines in his proposal a series of steps that he is interested in taking that would pull the resolution, if the committee, Judiciary Committee, doesn't take it up, that would pull it out and force votes on whether to bring it to the floor of the House for consideration. Those, as he says, would be the first steps in an impeachment process. He also, in the final element here, basically sends a signal to Democrats and says they need to understand that this isn't pure politics, that even though there are real concerns about impeaching Trump and bringing Mike Pence in as president, about seeking to impeach Trump and particularly and potentially rallying elements of Trump's base, about all the, you know, kind of all the tripwires that people associate with impeachment. But what Sherman is saying is that this stuff has got to stop, that the line has to be drawn at some point. And ultimately, it becomes necessary to make a moral as well as a political leap and say that, you know, you just cannot accept the continuing presidency of a man who obstructs justice, abuses his power, and potentially could do dramatically more damage.
So we think that Trump firing FBI Director James Comey was an obstruction of justice. But, you know, let's be fair to Trump here. We always want to be fair to Trump on our show. Trump said he was 100% willing to testify under oath about his conversations with Comey, that Comey has lied about them. And Alan Dershowitz has said the president was within his legal authority to order the head of the FBI to stop investigating anyone. So Alan Dershowitz's view is Trump doesn't need to deny it. He doesn't need to offer to testify under oath. He should just assert that he has the power to do it. And Alan Dershowitz is a law professor at Harvard.
Well, well laid out, my friend, and your fairness to the president is duly noted.
Thank you.
What I will only counsel you is, first and foremost, the president, as regards testifying under oath, has promised to do a lot of things. We're still waiting on dozens and dozens of absolute immediate commitments by Donald J. Trump to do this or that. And he never follows through. So, you know, if he wants to testify under oath, I don't know. Why doesn't he contact some people at relevant committees, say they'd like to go up to Capitol Hill? They'll put him under oath today. I mean, you know, he didn't have to wait for Robert Mueller to do it. We could do it in public with the U.S. Congress right now. I just don't think that that's his inclination. I doubt that he's anywhere near as serious about it as is suggested. In fact, I would go a step further. It's notable that the president said he's more than ready to testify under oath and you know, go for it, so to speak. His lieutenants and surrogates and allies were launching a major attack on Robert Mueller. And suggesting all sorts of negative impressions, even suggesting the possibility that the president could remove Mueller as this investigator into the president's actions. So I'm dubious about what Donald Trump says. I know I want to be as fair as you are, John, but I've got my doubts.
So,
secondly, as regards Alan Dershowitz,
yeah, okay,
I just would counsel that. He is expressing his view. He has every right to do that. Other professors at Harvard have different views, including people like Lawrence Tribe, who's obviously, you know, been a professor in many places and taught in many places and is highly regarded as a constitutional scholar. But beyond that, I'm sorry, this is not really a debatable point. The president has great power to appoint, to remove, but here's the bottom line. The congressional oversight over the president, established in the Constitution, sets up a system of checks and balances which clearly defines the presidency as something different than a monarchy. He does not have unlimited powers. While he can order people to do things, and he can order people not to do things, if he does so with the intent of protecting himself from legal inquiry or from an inquiry into wrongdoing, if he does so with the intent of protecting his associates from a legal inquiry or an inquiry into wrongdoing, that is an obstruction of justice. It is an abuse of power. He may have that power, but he doesn't have the power to abuse it. And with all due respect to Mr. Dershowitz, he's simply wrong on that issue.
You have convinced me. Thank you.
It's my job.
Well, some of our friends and colleagues think it's wrong for progressives to pursue the impeachment of Trump over his campaign's collusion with Russia. They say, first of all, it won't work. And more important, they say focusing on Russia is a new form of McCarthyism. What the Democrats really need to do is develop alternative policies that will win over some of the white working class of voters who supported Trump, and that this whole impeachment track is a big political mistake. What do you say to that?
I believe that people can walk and chew gum at the same time. I know it's a hard concept, but I'm going to go with it. And that, here's my basic premise on this. I spent the weekend at the People's Summit in Chicago, where we were talking with all sorts of folks from all sorts of backgrounds about moving beyond resistance, obviously resisting Trump, but also taking that next step to lay out the programs and the policies of a 21st century progressive movement. So I passionately agree with the notion that you have to develop alternatives to Trump and Trumpism. By the same token, I don't think that means that you can't pursue an effort to hold Trump to account for high crimes and misdemeanors. I think it would be wrongheaded to try and make that division. And the final thing I would suggest is this. At this point, no matter what one thinks about the Russia inquiries, and there are many of them being pursued at the congressional level and independent counsel, maybe even other ones that we don't even know every aspect of because they're happening via different law enforcement agencies or whoever's involved. All these different players have you know, some sort of hand in the process. Wherever that's going, whatever's being pursued there is one thing. The obstruction of justice and the abuse of power to limit or constrain inquiries is something else altogether. It is a different reality. It does not matter what you think about these inquiries if you conclude that the president sought to shut them down not because there was nothing to him, or even if there was, whatever, but that he did it for his own purposes, for the purpose of preventing inquiries into people associated with him, for the purpose of preventing perhaps inquiries into his own actions. And we need to make that separation in our head. When you're talking about obstruction of justice and abuse of power, that is not talking specifically about collusion with the Russians.
Yeah.
That's a discussion about abuse of a position. And that position, he is a constrained individual. The president of the United States is not a monarch. He does not have the authority from the moment he takes office to do whatever he wants. Forgetting about, putting aside whatever else he's done, which may be concerning, he doesn't have the power to use his office in that way. And if we cede him that power, again, no matter what you think about specific inquiries, this man will abuse it in much more dramatic ways. And so if you put impeachment off the table, in my opinion, I think you invite dramatically more significant abuses of power in the future.
One last thing. We're recording this before Attorney General Jeff Sessions' appearance with the Senate Intelligence Committee. But let's talk about the big picture just for a minute. of Jeff Sessions' role and future as Attorney General while the independent counsel Robert Mueller investigates Trump campaign collusion with the Russians. Where do we stand with Jeff Sessions at this moment?
Jeff Sessions is just a horrible mess of a public figure. This is a guy who, in his confirmation hearing, clearly failed to reveal information that he was specifically asked about, not once but twice, by Patrick Leahy and by Al Franken. There is some limited debate, about whether he committed perjury, i.e., he lied, or some other, failure to be truthful, or whether he is some, incompetent figure who can't remember meetings with major figures. Either one of those ought to be a pretty good argument that he shouldn't be the Attorney General of the United States. And then on top of that, when he got caught, remember, this guy never revealed that he had failed to tell the truth to the Senate, that he had failed to respond to specific questions. He got caught. When he got caught, he announced he was recusing himself from inquiries into these allegations of ties between Trump and the Russians. And then he turned around and participated in meetings and actions that led to the firing of the head of the FBI, apparently by Trump's own acknowledgement, out of concern about those inquiries into the Russians. And so here's a guy who's recused himself and then turned around and participated in the major actions as regards the inquiries from which he recused himself. I mean, this is it's incomprehensible. If you heard about it coming from some other country, it would be, the stuff of sort of shocking exposés of something that's gone horribly awry. And I will just remind you, I'm not obsessed with impeachment. I think there's a lot of other ways to hold people to account. But I will note that in their wisdom, the founders did say that you can impeach not just the president and the vice president, but civil officers. And the attorney general is a civil officer.
John Nichols, read him at thenation.com and read his new book, Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. It'll be out in August from Nation Books. John, thanks for talking with us today.
It's a total pleasure to be with you, my friend.
Well, that's it for today's Trump Watch. I want to thank my other guests. Amy Willance had the Jared Report. We also spoke with Harold Meyerson about the Republicans and the Democrats. Thanks to our engineer, D'Angelo Jones. Thanks to our producer, Renee Reynolds. And thanks, as always, to Rye Cooter for our theme music, Mambo Sinuendo. Coming up at 4 tonight on KPFK, This Is Happening, Jerry Quickly. Trump Watch returns next week at the same time on this same station. I'm John Wiener. Thanks for listening.